Always confuses me when the iPod says there's no microphone attached, just after I've plugged the microphone in. Okay. So, thank you. Julie's looking forward to reading those. She had nothing else to do this week. Okay, those are the exam analysis exercises that are due today. How was that? How many of you have done that kind of analysis of an exam in the past? A few of you. Okay. So, was it useful? Okay. What sorts of things did you learn? Some of you, I know, learned that you don't trust me when I ask all of the above questions. You couldn't believe that all of the above was correct so often. Yeah. One of the problems is not inhibiting your interpretation of the question until you get to the end. Several people that I've talked to have said they didn't read carefully enough, that they made assumptions about what the question was and jumped from the middle of the first sentence onto the answers and skipped over the second half of the sentence, and it doesn't work that way. So now you know to breathe deeply, stay calm, read the whole thing. Other discoveries? What else did you discover? Yes?
There weren't really a lot of comments on my essay questions. I don't know if that was like on everybody's, but that would have helped me a lot more.
Right. Yeah, I should have commented on that when we gave them back. It's very difficult for us to make any kind of extensive comments on the essays, just because there's so many of them, and there are only two of us. So I should have apologized for that. When there are obviously things missing, we try to, and I suspect that the questions that Julie answered or graded got more comments than the ones that I graded. So we'll try to do better next time, give you a little more feedback on them. But you were able to figure out, on reflection, how you might have improved it?
Yeah, reading it after a while.
Yeah. It's really, we know and you know that it's very difficult sitting in here, or in Fleming, with an hour and a half or 2 hours and lots of things going through your head, I mean the whole unit going through your head at the same time and all of those questions, to give sufficient depth to the answers to each of the essay questions that you choose. So it's hard to give the best possible answer under that kind of circumstance. That's why for advanced courses I like take-home exams. And I think you'll find that in a lot of your courses, some of you already have, that introductory courses, because they're so large, tend to have either no essays or short essays, and unless they have a lot of doctoral teaching fellows who can grade them, there tends not to be much extensive writing. But as you get farther up, take-home essay exams are much more common. And if you have a week or two and you can think about it, think about the question and go over material, it's a lot easier to do good work. And of course, the expectations are higher when you get to that point. Other discoveries? Was it fairly easy to come up with a plan to improve your score next time? Could you figure out what to do I know some of you have already talked to me. Well, it would be, you know, nice to do all the reading. That would help. That's an obvious one. Coming to lectures would be good. A couple of people have said, yeah, the ones I missed were from lectures I didn't go to. What can I say? So you have a good plan. Just remember, since we have an exam a week from today, that now's the time to put that plan into action. So if you really are going to do all the reading, you probably want to start now instead of Sunday night. And forming a study group this week would help rather than next week after the exam. So take all those good intentions and put them into practice as quickly as you can, and keep them there for the rest of the semester. But we're looking forward to reading them. I'm amazed that I forgot that I read them all last year. You all know about Freud. He said we repress painful experiences like childbirth and reading exams. Okay, we were talking about Piaget, and just to remind you, Piaget divides intellectual development into four stages. Yes, review session, one after class on Wednesday here, and on Sunday, I don't have a room yet, Sunday evening. And it'll either be 7 or 7:30. I was reminded that I'm supposed to be with friends for dinner Sunday evening, so I've got to work that out. Yes?
Are they cumulative or not?
Are they cumulative? Yes and no. I'm sorry. All of the questions on this exam will refer to material from this unit. But some of them will ask you to connect the material from this unit to the material from the last unit. So they're cumulative in the sense that you're now, you've been through the biological lifespan, and now you're adding the cognitive lifespan to that. And this unit includes the connections between those two. But I won't go back and ask any questions that are just about biological development. They will all have some element that refers to intellectual development. Okay. Other questions? Okay. Just the reminder that the essence of Piaget's description of intellectual development is that we start with our sensory motor systems gathering information, which the brain accumulates and helps us make sense out of. And then as we develop language, we develop ways to represent the information and the relationships that we have discovered through our actions in the world. We don't stop gathering information sensory motorily. We continue that, and we continue to represent it linguistically and in other ways. We also learn to draw things like falling sticks and represent that sensory motor experience in a graphic way. And then as we go up into the elementary school years, we begin to accept some of the basic notions of logic and begin to expect the world to behave in logical ways. So we learn to deal with logic within language, but also in other ways of representing it, we expect things to be consistent. And then as we go up into adolescence, we add to those abilities and expectations the ability to deal with relationships that we have created in our head using the skills of the previous stages. Okay. and I'm going to continue to illustrate some of those skills. We had talked about I've got the verbal and the numerical analogies confounded. We talked about verbal analogies. We talked about number series. And in both cases, one of the primary principles that I tried to illustrate was the notion of isomorphism, the ability to compare relationships to see if they have the same shape or form, if they are isomorphic. And I claimed that ability to compare patterns and see if they're the same is fundamental to intelligence. And what happens as we go through the stages is that the complexity and the abstractness of the patterns that we can think about and compare increases. So, going on with the task that you had in the quiz, we all know what a proverb is. A proverb is a homely way, an everyday language kind of way, to describe a relationship that may be quite abstract. And we do that because sometimes it's difficult to describe the abstract principles in our lives easily. But if we can find an everyday language analogy, an isomorphic instance, we can get the idea across. And so human beings think up and write proverbs. So in this task, what you have are three French proverbs, A, B, and C. And what Piaget did, and these are translated from a task that Piaget made up, what Piaget did was pick 10 relatively familiar to him French proverbs. When the cat's away, the mice will play, which we also are familiar with. The cowl does not make the monk. Filing can turn a stake into a needle. He had 7 more, but that was too big a task for me to put on one page. So I picked 3 of them. And then he had statements that matched each of the 10. And if you're familiar with statistics, you still need to have a choice at the end. So he had an 11th sentence that he made up. And the sentences were sort of an attempt to describe the principle that is represented in the proverb. And then he asked children and adolescents and college students to match them. So it's a task that requires isomorphism, the ability to recognize when you have a sentence that has the same meaning. The same meaning. It describes the same relationship or principle that the proverb describes. Okay. So which ones did you match? What did you match to A? X, Y, or Z? How many of you chose X? Y? Z? X, Y, or Z? X? Okay. Why? You meant why, okay. Okay. So the match is between when the cat's away, the mice will play, and those who waste their time neglect their business. Anybody choose something else? Everybody chose why. Oh, okay. How about B, the cowl does not make the monk. You know what a cowl is? It's a vocabulary word. The hood on a monk's robes. It also can refer to the curved covering of an airplane engine or other motor, but it doesn't in this case. Okay, so The cowl does not make the monk, and you match that to X. As we grow older, we grow better. Okay. Anybody choose something else? Z. Why? Oh, process of elimination. So C, and you think filing can turn a stake into a needle goes with X. As we grow older, we grow better. Okay. And you chose Z? No. X. Oh, X for B. All right. Okay. The cowl is making the monk better or not making... What's wrong here? Did you all enjoy this particular task? How many of you didn't like the math? You didn't like the math. So this was your task, right? This is the verbal reasoning stuff for the math phobics. Okay? And you're all happy with your answers? Yeah? You thought it was hard. What was hard about it? Okay, what, thinking about the relationships and how they fit together, why was that difficult in this case?
I like math.
You like math. Okay. Anybody else have difficulty with this? What was difficult? The relationships between the two didn't really make sense. Why would that be? They really aren't isomorphic, are they? How does that make you feel when you're doing something that you're supposed to be able to match these things, they're supposed to mean the same thing? What do you do with that when you don't see immediately that there's a correct answer? You make up silly reasons? You make up attempted reasons? Yeah. How do you feel about making up silly explanations for why they ought to match when you in fact know they don't match? You feel like you're not learning. What am I missing here? Yeah, maybe I should be a math major. Maybe I'm not college material. Right, how many of you have a self-esteem drop when you encounter a problem that looks like you ought to be able to do it and it doesn't seem to make sense? And self-esteem, you know, takes a little hit. Okay. Remember Piaget's notion of disequilibrium? Disequilibrium is the feeling you get when you're trying to interpret some experience using what you know and it's not working. There's something missing in it. That feeling of disequilibrium is the feeling of frustration, anger, annoyance, that what I'm trying to do, how I'm trying to do it, doesn't seem to be working. So does anybody have a good explanation for why so many of you experience, is that what you were feeling, disequilibrium? How many of you felt the disequilibrium? It just wasn't working. You could force the answers, you could force them together, you could come up with a best of the three, but I really don't like it kind of answer. Okay, enough of you experienced that we need to understand that. How could you interpret this problem in a way that would explain why it was difficult for you? Okay, so because these are proverbs, a couple of them that you're not really familiar with, maybe you don't understand how they're really used. Right? Okay, so that would be one way to explain it. They're too abstract. It is an abstract task. Okay. Yeah, and you're beginning, now that you're in college, you're beginning to question whether you have the skills of abstract thinking. Anybody have another explanation for why this might be creating so much disequilibrium? Any of you paranoid? Typically? A little bit? Okay. Ratchet your paranoia up. I put the wrong things together on purpose. These don't match. Those aren't the sentences that mean the same thing. It's a crock. Would you believe that? Is he right? What's your name?
Arnu.
Is Arnu right? Yeah, he's right. These don't match. These aren't the sentences that match the three proverbs that are listed. There is no right answer, except, Shelton, is this a typo or are you deliberately screwing with my mind? I'm deliberately messing with your mind. They don't match. And you know that. But as Catherine suggested, you know, when you know they don't match, but you're supposed to come up with the answer, you finagle around until you can explain them, but you know deep down in your mind, in the place where you experience disequilibrium, you know they don't really match. And they don't. Piaget had sentences that matched. I should actually make an overhead of those so you could see. They really do match. They're quite simple. And if I had those up, you would have absolutely no difficulty with them because you are abstract thinkers. You really can do this task, but you can't do it when it's set up in an impossible way. I did it so you could feel the disequilibrium. And I did it also because the way you explain the matches that you make is pretty much exactly what concrete operational children do with this task. They match pretty randomly. It's not randomly. They go down through the list and they read the proverbs and they can tell you sort of what they mean and then they will match them to sentences and then they will take specific connections between the proverb and the sentence they choose, and they will use that specific connection to justify why they've matched it. The problem for them is that they can't even do the task, even when they have the right answer in front of them. They have the matching statements. 8, 9, 10-year-olds can't take that step of comparing the abstract relationships. So they do things like match when the cat's away the mice will play with those who waste their time neglect their business. That's a fairly typical match for 9 and 10 year olds. And I think what's happening in that case is that they're thinking about Tom and Jerry cartoons and the fact that cats chase the mice around. And in fact, in the Tom and Jerry cartoons, Tom never actually catches Jerry, right? Sometimes he gets him and then Jerry gets away, so it's really a waste of time for the cat. But I think they're looking at the excitement and seeing it as a waste of time. Sometimes they match A, when the cat's away the mice will play, with Z. Again, I think they're looking at the excitement of the chase of Tom and Jerry. What they're not getting is the real principle of when the cat's away, the mice will play. When do you use that? You use that to describe a situation, not about cats and mice. That's just the homely way of referring to the general principle. What that proverb refers to is any situation where you have a social system in which there's a dominant figure and a subordinate figure whose naturally occurring behavior would be inappropriate for the situation, and the presence of the dominant figure inhibits the undesirable naturally occurring tendencies of the subordinate figure in the system, and in the absence of that dominant figure, the naturally occurring undesirable behavior emerges. That's what sociology would say. That's what sociology is, actually. It's the science or the art of saying simple things in very complex language. That's sociology. That's what they're about. And in this particular case, we use the proverb for any situation where we have that kind of social situation. So, teacher goes out of the room, leaves the second graders to do their homework, goes down to the office telling them to do their work. She'll be right back. She comes back and all hell has broken loose and there are paper airplanes and fights going on and the kids are all over the room. And being a good teacher, she says, "Aha! When the cat's away, the mice will play." And the kids all scramble back to their seats. And then they have a discussion of the proverb. And this is what happens in second and third grade. When the cat's away, the mice will play. To the concrete operational child in elementary school refers to cats and mice. It doesn't refer to teachers and students. So they'll have a discussion about the mouse that their cat brought home last night and it wasn't dead and the cat let it go in the living room and mom screamed and got up on the table, you know, all those stereotypic things. And they will trade those stories, but they don't get the abstract principle of the dominant and subordinate characters. And they don't get that the teacher is actually referring to what happened in the classroom. They get it, but they think she's schizophrenic. They don't have the abstract relational ability to do the task. But they can do very creative things. One of my favorites, in Piaget's book about this kind of task, one of the proverbs is, "White dust will never come out of a sack of coal." Yeah. We have a similar one. You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. Yeah. If something is is corrupt or polluted or base or inadequate or inferior, you're not going to be able to make something superior and wonderful out of it. So the French use, "White dust will never come out of a sack of coal," referring to people that you can't have very high expectations for. They're not going to do the right thing. They're not going to do the best thing. You know, don't have your hopes up. So in one of Piaget's interviews, he asks a 9-year-old to match that, and she does a wonderful job, and she matches it with, "Those who waste their time neglect their business." And he says, tell me why they mean the same thing. And she does the wonderful 9-year-old creative thing, using her concrete operational ability to create a narrative sequence. And she says, I'll paraphrase it, "Some people neglect their business. Some parents neglect their children." Okay, we have similarity now. Neglect your business, neglect your children. They don't wash them, and they become as black as coal, and no white dust comes off them. Okay. Very intelligent 9-year-old. She's very articulate. She can explain the connections. She can make a moral story. Don't neglect your children or they'll become black as coal. But the two sentences don't really mean the same thing. And she will understand that when she's 13 or 14 or 15, but at 9, she doesn't get it. Okay? So, let me comment on the fact that you used your disequilibrium to do several things. One is, some of you looked at the task, read the items, said, I don't know what he's talking about, and went on to the next task. That's one of the things we do when we are experiencing too much disequilibrium. We bail. So cognitive overload or being given a task that you don't really comprehend causes many of us to bail. We just, okay, I can't do it. If we do it and we still aren't sure that we understand it, some of us internalize that, as the psychologists would say, and decide that we're really not that smart. There's something wrong with our intelligence. I'm not too bright. Wow. Ugh. I don't get it. Okay. And we blame ourselves for not being able to understand. Some of us dig. We get more curious. Some of us perseverate. Some of us will stay on that kind of task until we're convinced that we've got it. I don't do that on the Proverbs because I know this one, but I'll give you an example from the last 2 days. My mother at 92 does the crossword puzzles in the Free Press in ink, and as you may or may not know, the Monday puzzle is typically pretty easy, and by the time you get to Saturday, it's really complex. Not as bad as the New York Times, which she doesn't do. But they get harder. So she does Monday and Tuesday. When I go see her tonight, she'll have done Monday, she'll have it all answered. Tuesday, I might have the opportunity to help with a word or two. Wednesday, a few more words. Thursday, and maybe Friday, there'll be a bit more for me to do. And Saturday, we both struggle. Fortunately, the answer doesn't come out till Monday. They skip Sunday. So we get 2 days to work on it. So Saturday's was a bear. And she got very little of it, and I got about a third of it. And then I went back yesterday, and instead of talking with her and making nice and doing chores for her, I sat there eating chocolate chip cookies, struggling with the crossword puzzle with her. And we got another third of it. And then we got another corner. But when I left last night to go to the airport to pick up my wife, we had several words we didn't have. And usually we just say, well, forget it. Forget it? No. This is major disequilibrium, not to be able to finish a stupid crossword puzzle. Right? So I went home, I got my own copy of Saturday's paper, I took out that section, I folded it up, put it in my pocket, went to the airport, assuming the plane would be late, and I got it. I got it. I solved the damn thing. And I went to the phone, and I called my mother, and said, Mom, I got it, here are the answers, and that's great. You know, and she's very proud of me. You know. Her son, the guy who, instead of doing anything useful, perseverates on this stupid crossword puzzle and doesn't know when to quit. There's such a wonderful feeling of having finished it. And then I could toss the paper and it's all over, you know, it's great. That's what some of us do with disequilibrium. Now, how long do you work on serving a tennis ball to perfect your game? How long do you work on a take-home essay exam to get the wording exactly right? How many times do you edit and revise the lyrics to the song you're writing until you get it just right? That's what you do with disequilibrium. It drives intellectual accomplishment. It may drive physical accomplishment, athletic skill. Disequilibrium may drive us to do dumb things in relationships. We'll talk about this in the next unit, but one of the experiences of disequilibrium that some of you have is breaking up with somebody and not being able to agree on why you're breaking up. You know? And there's a drive for some people to resolve that disequilibrium, to agree on what was wrong with the relationship. So people get back together because they agree temporarily, and then they break up again, and they have this recurring cycle of on and off relationship because they're really trying to come to agreement on why their relationship doesn't work. And eventually, after a lot of therapy, they will come to understand that it doesn't work because you don't agree on why it doesn't work. And in fact, you should quit trying. Throw the puzzle away or end the relationship and stop trying to figure it out. But mostly, stop trying to get the other person to agree with you as a way of resolving the disequilibrium. It doesn't work. And it's not okay to stalk the other person or threaten the other person so that he or she will agree on why the relationship doesn't work. Okay? So there are many uses of disequilibrium and many different ways of responding to it. We can put ourselves down, we can question our ability, we can perseverate, we can get angry. I'm amazed at how civilized you all are. I have been doing this task with classes for years. I have never gotten a call in the middle of the night saying, I have been working on your damn puzzle for 3 days and I hate you and I'm dropping the course. Yeah. Nobody ever turns that anger toward me. So we really are a civil society. I appreciate that. Okay. I'm going to run very quickly through this task, the last one, and just talk to you a bit about some of the ways you might have approached it. How many of you thought about using factorials? Math majors, right? And then you realize that that's not a factorial question. There is no factorial formula. You remember factorials? Some of you do, some of you don't. You know, that one? You know, 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1 something or other over n minus 1 times x or, you know, I don't remember them either. How many of you learned factorials? How many of you remember them? How many of you can use them in your daily life? No, okay. A couple of you. Why do they teach them in school? I have no idea either. There they are. They're one of those things we learn, promptly forget because we never have to use it, but we recognize sometimes that we ought to be able to apply it. Unfortunately, this isn't one of those situations, so they don't apply. What this task is designed to do is to demonstrate that when you tackle this kind of task, most of us figure out some kind of systematic way to look at all the possibilities, keep track of them, and come up with an answer that we can be fairly confident about. When children do this task, they start adding things up, and then they start forgetting what the sums were, and then they keep adding them up in different ways. How many of you actually got out a set of coins, 2 pennies, a nickel, a dime, 2 dimes, and a quarter? How many of you got that and got out a set of coins to do this? Okay. How many of you tried to do the task? Let's get down to the nitty-gritty. Okay. How many of you got out coins to do it? Okay, if you're a child, you have to have the coins. If you're an adolescent thinking formal operationally, you know you don't have to have the coins. So that's one difference between children and adolescents and adults, that we don't have to have the coins. We can do this. How many of you took out a sheet of paper and started figuring out some kind of matrix for keeping track of all the possibilities? Some of us do. Okay. And we figured there's some systematic way to do it. How many of you actually came up with an answer? Okay. And very quickly, what was your answer? 28? 32? What? 12? 32? Anything else? Don't be afraid. 34? 33? 30? Yeah, pretty much covered that. Anybody get one? Why didn't you yell that out? You thought it was so dumb to only get one. But you got one, and I know how you got one. And that's one of the correct answers. One of the correct answers. Okay? What happens in this task is that years ago I adapted it, and it was supposed to demonstrate making some kind of matrix and keeping track and getting it all together, and that's the scientific method. Until a woman engineering student said, oh, well, it's a min-max problem. Now, all you have to do is figure that the biggest sum you can make is 52, and the smallest would be 1 if you had 1 penny. And then everything else you can figure out. You can make anything that ends in 1, 2, 5, 6, or 7, or 0, but you can't make anything that ends in 3 or 4, because you only have 2 pennies. You can't make anything that ends in 8 or 9, because you only have 2 pennies. And so you can go through and eliminate between 1 and 52 all of the sums that you can't make, and the rest are possible, and you just count them. And you come up with 32 or 28 or one of those numbers. Okay? And that's fine. It's fine. What's wrong with it? Those of you who got one. Why would somebody get one? Go ahead. Right. Okay. Then along came somebody who knew set theory. Right? If you have to use the set of coins, and you don't specify that you can divide the set, set theory requires that you use each of the elements once and only once, and that you have to use all of them in the set. And that's 52 is the total. So there's only one sum that you can make if you believe in set theory. If you subdivide the sets, then you can make more. But how many of you know what a sum is? Is that what you just said? Sum? How do you get a sum? You have to add. So anything that can only be made with one coin is not a sum. So one is not a sum. It's an amount, but it's not a sum. So you eliminate the one, you eliminate five, you eliminate 10, because you're making those with one coin and that's not a sum. So if you follow that rule, then there is a smaller number of sums. And the person who got 12, is that how you got that? No? Okay. All right. So you see that this is a completely flawed problem. It's actually quite a complex problem. It didn't used to be, but it's gotten more complex over the years as I've learned more mathematics, being taught by students. More mathematics, set theory, some of those sorts of things. What the correct answer is depends on the definitions of the elements of the problems. This is economics, right? That's what an economist says. Well, it depends on what assumptions you make. And that is a problem here. Is that okay? Is that okay that a problem has different correct answers depending on the definitions that you use? How many of you think that's okay? How many of you think that's a crock? Yeah, okay. But it really is okay to have a problem that has different correct answers depending on the definitions that you use. Unless you're in elementary school, in which case you cannot do that, or they ride you out of town, out of the class, on a rail. Because concrete operational kids assume that there is only one correct answer, and the teacher is supposed to know it, and that if you have a problem that can be interpreted in two ways, or three or four or five, as this one can, there's something wrong with the problem and the idiot who made it up. That's a concrete operational kid's response to that kind of task. As kids become formal operational, they begin to have fun devising alternative interpretations of problems. They like problems that could be interpreted more than one way. And those of you who remember high school, remember yourself or somebody else loving to give a different interpretation of a question, a problem, in order to tweak the teacher. Right? That was fun. That was fun. And some kids, my daughter was one of those, came to loathe teachers who thought there was only one way to do something. She had a I can't do that. Some of you went to the same high schools, same teachers are still teaching. She had a teacher in one subject who thought there was only one way to do things, and then she had another teacher in the same subject who loved the fact that she would figure out alternative ways, because he believed that that was the way you learn math. You figure out how everything is connected to everything else, and that's what is the fun of math, that there are alternative ways to do things. And the teacher who had the very narrow view, okay, so he wasn't as mature, perhaps. Or maybe it was a female. We don't remember. Anyway. Okay. Enough on that. Again, there's disequilibrium. And in this case, there's disequilibrium generated by the fact that you've listed about seven or eight possible correct answers. And the task then becomes to figure out what definitions you use and how you got that answer. Because all of those are probably right, given some particular set of definitions. Okay. Summary moment. And this is on the web, so don't write it down. I just wanted to give you some sense of what happens as you become a formal operational thinker as you go into adolescence. And these characteristics apply through adulthood, too. So what you're doing as you become an adolescent and become formal operational is that you're learning to think like the adults do, which might annoy them because you start to win arguments. With formal operational or adult reasoning, you assume there's a systematic set of possible combinations or possibilities, like this last task. You understand the need to record information when there's too much to remember. The text calls that metacognition. You derive and test hypotheses using the logic of hypothetico-deductive analysis. You can coordinate two or more different systems of reference into a single complex structure. Remember the number series we had that was alternating or decreasing by one. -5, -4, -3, -2. you can appreciate the similarities and dissimilarities of complex relationships, ones that are isomorphic and non-isomorphic. And you can analyze abstract systems of relationships mentally. Let me give you a couple of more examples and look at how children and adolescents tackle them. One of my favorites is that as we go through childhood, we learn two completely separate systems of representing things. One of those is called the alphabet. Okay. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J. And we learn to pronounce the letters if we're doing it phonetically. We learn to put them together to read. And then we learn a completely different system, which is arithmetic. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And measurement. Inches, feet, yards, miles, marathons. And through the elementary years, we're expected to be able to operate within each of those systems consistently. And we do. You know, second and third and fourth graders learn to read and write. They learn to spell. They love that. They learn to count. They learn to measure. That's fine. They do the problems very well. And then they get up about fourth or fifth grade and they get into a class, and it's usually math class, and this is what happens to them. Train A leaves the station in Paris at noon, and it travels west. No, I better go east. Geography is not part of this. But it's going some direction. And it's going at 40 kilometers per hour. Train B leaves the same station on the same track at 4 p.m. And it travels at 50 kilometers per hour. How far from Paris and when does train B catch up to train A? How many of you remember this? How many of you love these? How many of you hated these? You know why you hated them? I just told you. Because you had two completely different concrete systems of reference: language and measurement of time and distance. And this problem requires that you put them together in a systematic way. And then within that system, word problems. Word problems probably create more math phobic people than any other of the wonderful tasks of mathematics. The other problem is that they start at different times. So there's a 4-hour gap here in the start. So we've got to figure out how far this one goes in an hour, and where is it when this one starts 4 hours later? Well, that's pretty simple. It's 160 kilometers out when this one starts. And this one's going to catch up 10 kilometers per hour. So it's going to take it 16 hours to catch up to where this one was when it's... No, it's not. It's going to take it... 3 hours and And 160, 10 kilometers more, 3 hours and 1/5. Oh, shit. So we have 3.2 hours to get to where this one was when this one started. In the meantime, in 3.2 hours, this one's going to have gone on. What you're creating is a very complex set of relationships of distance covered and time until you figure out, and if you are working your way up toward algebra, when the trains will have covered the same distance, which is the question. So now you've got to figure out formulas for how fast this one is going and for how long, and you've got to add the time that it wasn't going, and you've got to put all that into a complex system that includes the time and the distance and the speed and explain it in English, and you're now in overload, cognitive overload. Okay. Some of us absolutely adore those problems. And some of us are thrown into so much disequilibrium by them that we can't possibly cope with them. Okay. They are formal operational tasks. Because of the complexity of putting together the different systems of representation. Okay, having boggled your mind with that one, let me give you another of my favorites. Piaget didn't do these. That's my contribution. Here's one that Piaget did. And, no, erasing the board was not the task. I'm not sure if you can see this, but we'll do it this way. Okay, here's the task, as Piaget did it. Here's a table. And on this table, there's a rack of empty test tubes. And there are four beakers here. And some paper and pen. And the four beakers are all the same size, and they all have a colorless liquid. They have colorless liquids in them. And they're labeled scientifically. 1, 2, 3, and 4. That's scientific notation. Okay. And then there's an eyedropper here. It's another colorless liquid, eyedropper in a bottle. And it's labeled G. G, I wonder what's in that. And here's the task. Out of my back pocket, I'm going to take a test tube. And it has colorless liquid in it. And I took this liquid from these beakers. And I'm going to take the eyedropper, and I'm going to carefully put 3 drops of whatever the G stuff is in. And my colorless liquid in my test tube is going to turn bright orange. Like that? Cool. Your task is to figure out how to make that happen. Go. So, what do you want to do? What are you going to do? What? You're going to get a chemistry textbook? Okay, I can do this with 8-year-olds. What's the chemistry textbook going to tell you? I'm not going to tell you what's in it. Okay, so you want to start putting things from, putting liquids from each of the beakers into a test tube. and add G to it and see if any of them turn bright orange. That seem reasonable? Start with each one separately. None of them turned orange. Now what? Change one variable at a time. So what are you going to do next? Okay, one and two. Yeah, that didn't work. What are you going to do now? Three and four? That didn't work. Now what? You tried them all. Oh, you're going to do it systematically. Okay. So, and is there a way to do that? So you're going to add one and two and G, and that didn't work. I did three and four, and that didn't work. Two and three doesn't work. Three and four, or two and four, that didn't work. What? Two and three didn't work. And I'm adding G each time, because that's kind of critical. One and three, oh by golly, that worked. She got it. One and three worked. Okay. Now what do you know? Now what? What do you want to do, Aaron? You don't know? Okay. You tried all the double combinations and one and three worked. So you walk away from it now, you're all happy? Could you do three at a time? Oh, you could do, why would you do that? You've already made it turn orange. You don't know if it's one or three, or the combination. Okay, so you want to try other combinations. Okay, so what are you going to try? One, two, three. That worked. Now you know two ways to make it work. One and three. One, two, three. One, three, four? No. Two, three, four? No. One, two, four? No. So did we try all the three-way combinations? Okay, what's left? All four? That doesn't work. Okay, so what do you know now? You've made it orange two ways, 1, 3, 1, 2, 3. Four changes it? Cancels it? How might you demonstrate that? Right, but it doesn't. So she's thinking that 1 and 3 works, 1, 2, 3 works. So 1, 3, 4, or 1, 2, 3, 4 should work, but it doesn't. So 4 cancels it. Is there a way to... 2's neutral? Okay. What do you know? Why does 4 cancel it? Can you prove that it cancels it? Okay. Right. Since it doesn't, what could you do to prove to me that 4 cancels it? Cancels the color. Right. You got 1 and 3, and that's orange, so now put 4 in it, and by golly, it turns clear. Whoa! You did it. So 4 does... what? Counteracts the reaction? 1 and 3 are necessary. 2 doesn't seem to be relevant. Okay. I've got 7 minutes. I'm going to use them all. Let me explain what you just did. If you were in the stage of sensory motor operations, you could do this task, but it would probably be dangerous. Okay. Because the way you would do it would be to start grabbing test tubes and pouring. And I don't need to tell you what these are, but you probably don't want your infants and toddlers or even your preschoolers playing around with them. None of them are, they're not going to blow up, but they're not good for you. Okay? If you're a pre-operational child, you could do that, but you could also talk about what you were doing. You could say, this is neat, it's like cooking. Or like when I take my bath, I pour water. You could say that kind of stuff. If you were a concrete operational child, you could tackle this, and concrete operational kids do. They have fun with it. They start mixing things up. What they don't do is figure out all the possible combinations. And the youngest concrete operational kids start where you did, which is let's do one and then two and then three and then four. None of those worked, so you must have tricked me. I tried them all. What you had didn't come from here. The next level up from that, they add the complexity of, oh, you could try mixing them. And they do one and two, three and four. And then they say, I tried them all. Because they did try them all in 2x2 combinations, but not all the possible 2x2 combinations. The next step up is to figure that you can do them in more combinations, and then eventually you get up toward formal operational thinking where you know there is a way to figure out all the possible combinations and try them. The problem with most concrete operational kids is that they forget the science education they've had. Science education in elementary school is all about observing and recording your data. And they come into this task and they start pouring and they completely, there's a paper here, there's a pencil, and they completely forget that they're supposed to keep track of their observations. There's no carryover from the third grade classroom to my lab. Just, it's predictable. So they get it sometimes, but they don't remember how, and when they get it, then they don't go that next step, which is maybe there's another way to do it. And it's not until they get close to adolescence that they come up with all the possible combinations and how can I figure out what four does. So thinking about the hypotheses that you generate and testing them systematically using, one of you said, one variable at a time, that's the key to the scientific method. Now, there's another step beyond that, which is the one you did. How many of you followed this task and understood what we were doing? If you understood at all what we were doing and followed it, even if you didn't get the answers, you are clearly well into formal operational abstract thinking for one simple reason. There ain't no chemicals on this table. There are no test tubes, there are no beakers, there are no chemicals, there's no paper, nothing turned orange. You did this task entirely abstractly, verbally. You believed me. You reasoned about what I was saying. There are no chemicals here. There are no beakers. If you could follow that, you were creating a mental image and being able to reason about the relationships within it completely mentally. You did not need the chemicals or the test tubes or the orange color. You could do this task in your mind. And that's the difference between the concrete operational kid who has to have the concrete stimuli, has to see it, and the abstract formal operational thinker who can create the system, think within it logically, and evaluate its consistency and compare it to other systems. And I'll take 2 minutes on Wednesday to give you another system to see if you can compare it to. Thank you.